the concept of resolutions, making changes in life. I read a hilarious statistic a couple of years back about how few resolutions people actually keep. And the reason for this is pretty easy to explain, why we always want to set these self-improvement agendas and why we tend to... And they can be so well-meaning and so obviously well-intended. And yet, very often, even the most skillful ones will just fall by the wayside. And there are a number of reasons why. I'm just going to go through some of them. We come from a culture of punishment and reward very early in life. Kids are punished for failing to meet rules. And very often, whether it's in schools or parenting or what have you, the way punishment is meted out is the children are singled out. They're given labels, like Joey is a thief, he stole candy from the store. And then there's a punishment. The child is separated from doing things that he likes. And until a period of time has passed. In schools, it's very similar. Kids are sent to the principal's office and then to detention. So all the way across the board to whether military or higher education, there's this constant theme of isolating, attaching of labels, depriving. While you're under punishment, you're deprived of things. And then after a period of time when just punishment has been meted out, then people are returned. And so this whole tactic involves, unfortunately, the introduction of a lot more stress and suffering into generally what is already a very stressful event. People act unskillfully, selfishly, through violence or aggression or out of fear because they're suffering, because they're stressed out. People don't just wake up and say, oh, I'm feeling good today, I'm going to go shout at somebody who cuts me off, because that would be the fun thing to do. We act unskillfully because we're carrying around a lot of stress. We're feeling overwhelmed by life. There's an enormous amount of... Already the human mind is a subcommittee filled with not only wise voices and caring voices, but inner judges, harsh critics, and the voices of incessant fear. And so we carry all this around with us, and then on top of it, when we fall short, then, unfortunately, culturally, the solution is to add more stress and suffering. You're bad, you're this or that, you don't deserve to be, you're going to be separated, isolated, sent to detention, and then when punishment has been effectively meted out, then you'll be given another chance to be a normal human being. So this whole story then feeds into any pre-existing sense that we have of low self-esteem, or there's something wrong with me. This sense of punishment just builds into it. And so, of course, a lot of us, when we set resolutions or desires to change, we bring this habit of, oh my God, if I fall short, the way I'll greet it is with a sense of being a failure, and I don't deserve then to treat myself well or splurge on anything or reward myself because I've not exercised, or I didn't meditate today, or I didn't or I drank again or whatever. And this whole process, unfortunately, tends to be widespread. Very often when we want to have, for example, resolutions fall into two categories. We either want to add something virtuous to our lives, or we want to remove something unskillful. So if we want to add, say, an exercise program to our lives, it's one thing just to do exercise, which requires a lot of patience and being patient because you'll not see immediate results. But on top of it, if we bring in these issues of our the way we view our bodies and this sort of sense of being ugly or being, you know, not attractive, this inner critic will just make it so much more difficult because we're now associating exercise with all these feelings of low self-esteem. As I was talking with a friend, we all have economic insecurity. And yet, a lot of us then attach that economic insecurity to, oh, I've got to get a job, or I've got to get a better job. And of course, if we attach the fear of financial insecurity to the process of getting a job, you know what happens? Avoidance happens. It becomes so unpleasant and so overwhelming, and we have this feeling of so much stress now we're attaching with getting new work or searching for a new project to do, that we just put it off. Because we've now added onto an already difficult thing, looking for work, changing a job, going on interviews, presenting ourselves. That's not easy. That's already stressful, but then we attach to it, oh, I'm a financial ruin, you know. Darkness is all ahead, is encompassing. So it's really important to detach these resolutions from these voices of fear or inner criticism and just do it for the fun of it. Just do it for the fun of it. To reward ourselves for any effort rather than rewarding ourselves for perfection. Perfectionism and accomplishment are the enemies of change. All they are bars that we raise continually just out of reach so that we don't feel good about ourselves. I was talking a few weeks ago about a clinical study where they followed the children of parents who rewarded them for their effort as opposed to the children of parents who rewarded them for their grades. And the children of parents who were rewarded for their grades drop out of school. And the only tools they learn is how to argue with their teachers over their grades. The children who were rewarded for effort tend to continue on in school, tend to move on through graduate school, and tend to find jobs that they're very engaged with. So it's about, listen to how liberal and progressive I sound, but I am, you know, but it's about rewarding ourselves just for the effort, not punishing, not setting high bars. In fact, I really strongly believe that the way to change is by setting the bar as low as you possibly can. Low as you possibly can. I learned every year I try to learn something new. And I completely let go of the ever getting good at something, because at my age, you don't get good at anything. You're lucky to be deeply mediocre. That's like a major accomplishment. Yeah, I learned to roller skateboard. I got my first skateboard when I was 45, and I looked like, my inner voice told me, I looked like the world's most uncoordinated cretin. And 10-year-olds were quick to agree with that inner voice as they sped by, laughing at me and, you know, howling at, you know, I looked basically like some kind of gangly bird, you know, pushing every 3 feet. But when I let go of the, oh, I've got to be able to get, you know, across town on this, and instead set the bar of, I just want to try doing this for 15, 20 minutes a day. And if I do that, that's great. And if I don't, that's okay. That's it. That's the entire motivational scheme. Anything beyond it, any bringing in of failing, any concept of failing or falling short, immediately makes the learning process too stressful and will bring in avoidance. So what I do is I just say, okay, if I can, I'm going to try to do 10, 15 minutes on this a day, and it doesn't matter if I never get any better. Just, I'm going to feel good for the fact that I brought out this stupid skateboard and I pushed myself around and I actually got to a place where I could get across town and could, you know, pick up groceries on it and stuff like that. And then every other friend I had broke his wrist skateboarding and I've sort of pretty much like haven't done it that much this year, but I learned it. I learned it. And, you know, that's the way I approach every new endeavor, which is completely divorce myself from the concept that there's any possibility of failure. Because the moment I bring in a fail-pass thing, already that kind of thinking alerts the inner critic, the inner perfectionist, and I'm already going to be attaching the whole process to far, far too much stress and self-judgment. Plus, those voices are never appeased. The inner fear voice is never satisfied. You cannot reason with it. A lot of us make the cardinal mistake of trying to reason with our fear, for instance, our financial fear. Guess what? It's from a part of the brain that doesn't understand reasoning. It's the biggest waste of time. There are billionaires in the world who are worried about money. External things will never answer these internal committee members. The amygdala, which creates fear, is a pre-verbal part of the brain. You could come up with the most eloquent argument you possibly could ever have, and it will not understand. Its job is to be frightened, pure and simple. So the way I relate to it is I detach it from all of my endeavors, my self-improvement schemes or whatever, and I simply, when they come up, I just say, hi, fear. Good to know you're there. No, you're not going to go away. You're never going to go away. And sometimes fear will throw up. It attaches, it sends some dopamine to the frontal lobe, and the frontal lobe will kick up a terrifying thought at the behest of fear. It'll throw up, oh, nobody's going to like you. You're a failure. What is it all amounted to? Whatever. And so that first thought, again, that's not my responsibility. That's just fear sending a missile across the bow. But my responsibility is to say, okay, I see it. Fear, it's not just enough that you're making me feel all tight, you're changing my breath, you're making my belly feel contracted, you're making my jaw tight, but you're now throwing a thought across the bow, and that's fine. But I don't argue with those thoughts. What I do is I go into the body, I relax the body, relax the breath. I take the roundabout way of dealing with fear. Interestingly, when we study, when I do, because you probably have more fun things to do, when I sit through and read a lot of the old Buddhist texts, there's very, very, very little conception of punishment anywhere in it. The Buddha has the oldest organization in the world. The Order of Monks is 2,500 years old. It's been going on peacefully for that long. And there's a very big code of ethics called the Vinaya, and in it there's a part called the Kulavaga. And inside of that there's a section called the blah, 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 which I can't remember, the Khandasa. And inside of that are this one small section of dealing with monks that fall short, that break the rules. And interestingly enough, if they immediately acknowledge that they've fallen short, that they go to another monk and they say, you know what, I accepted food I shouldn't accept, I slept too late, I missed a tour, there's no punishment. The only time, in fact, there's no real punishment throughout, the only time they have to do anything is if they conceal for a while. Then what happens is, rather than punishment, the Buddha taught that, well, they should be given an opportunity to just understand why these rules are in place. So they're offered the duties that most of the monks don't like. They're relieved of until they want to return. And where they're ready to say why they've repeated it or why they've concealed it. So it's not about any form of punishment. It's about giving the monks the opportunity to understand why the rules are there and why in the long term they don't want to break them, because it's going to be to their own detriment. In our culture is founded on what is best described, and certainly this time of year appropriate, the Santa Claus myth, which is basically, A, there's somebody watching you, could be a Santa Claus or a god, but you're being watched. It's a little bit like that Sting song. The most creepy lyrics ever. Anyway, don't like the guy, creepy lyrics, creepy song, but it does get to some gestalt there, which is there's something watching over you. You're being judged. And if you're nice, you get a present. And if you're naughty, you don't. And that whole thing is based on this idea that everything's settled externally. Now, the Buddha's path, there is no God. You're not being watched. Nobody's judging you. What we have is something called karma, which is simply that if I act out of envy, greed, jealousy, anger, then I'm creating those mind states in my mind, and my mind will be a deeply unpleasant place for me to be in the future, because that's an unpleasant mind to be in. As anybody who's ever been furious, resentful, shamed, guilty, knows, these are not states we want to plant into our mind. Any thought I think, any attitude I actively give energy to, those, and neuroscientists show us that anything we think repeatedly, we hard ingrain. We neurally rewire the brain, so those thoughts become more efficient. And eventually those thoughts get rewired to the striatum, which means they're habitually triggered. This is what karma is. The more we think, the more we hold certain views, the more we hold certain attitudes and give energy to them, we're creating the likelihood that those thoughts and attitudes will arise again in the future. That's all karma is. Nobody watching you. Nobody judging you. It's all about making your mind as pleasant a place as you want it to be. And you do that by focusing on thoughts and actions that create a pleasant mind. Peaceful thoughts. Thoughts of feeling deeply compassionate when we fall short rather than angry with ourselves. Thoughts of being of appreciation when we do something or we put any effort into anything, feel that sense of, oh, I tried. I really put some time into this. Thoughts of balance, which is, okay, sometimes we try something, it doesn't pay off, it doesn't mean it was a waste of time, it means we get to cross that off our list and move on to something else. There's opportunities everywhere. There is no failure. There is no failure. And finally, of course, there's metta, kindness. The underlying conditions that allow for change in life is not the sense that there's something wrong with me, that I've got to change because I can't be peaceful or happy now. That just creates more and more stress and more suffering and plants more and more future sadness. What we do, in fact, continually return to is thoughts of, I deserve to be happy. I deserve to be peaceful. And that peacefulness is always available. And it's available not by accumulating or making people like me or making things that, you know, I can hold on to, the real true happiness that I get comes from putting aside all the big agendas for a moment and making myself really calm and peaceful within. Really learning to find a sense of connectedness that's much deeper with myself. So these are the ways that we go about making any change. With a relentlessly positive, forgiving, compassionate, setting the bar really low. I've met plenty of people who have half an hour, 40-minute a day meditation programs who started out with 3 minutes a day. I've never met somebody who said, I want to meditate 40 minutes a day, who continued. Jails, prisons, institutions, of which I've spoken at many over the years, are filled with people who beat up on themselves, who punish themselves, who think thoughts of, I'm not good enough. These thoughts do not ever make us change in an appreciably skillful direction. The only motivation that does is compassion and kindness. The feeling that we deserve to be happy. So that's tonight's talk.